Okay, tonight we're going to be covering, what course is that? Ten. Okay. Courses 10, 11, and 12 were devoted to the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Master Shantideva. And originally in the 5-year course or 7-year course, whatever it was, it ended up taking a year to get through the whole Bodhisattva Charavatara. Rinpoche took 10 years, so it wasn't so bad, right? And we studied a very famous commentary by Gyaltsep Jay, one of Jetsun Kapa's, the primary disciple of Jetsun Kapa, and hasn't been translated yet, but we translated most of it, and we went through it for 3 courses. It's interesting that in the monastery, they don't study the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life as one of the 5 great books, but we added it. And there was a reason to spend a whole year on it, and that was because it's simply one of the greatest books ever written in the history of mankind. It's been translated, 5-6 times into English. And I don't think you can read even a bad translation of it and not be impressed by it. It's amazing. And there have been some good translations. So, and His Holiness has given commentary on it. For example, I saw him in Tucson give an extraordinary commentary on the Patience chapter. And they're trying very hard to get him back to do the chapter on wisdom, which is one of the greatest presentations on emptiness ever written. And I think triggered a lot of the teachings that have gone on here since. The 9th chapter is dedicated to how to view your world, and I think as we went through it, I personally, and I think a lot of other people, had a profound change in the way they viewed their life and their world. Especially I remember the Halloween night lecture. I don't know why, but on Halloween night we got to the heaviest part of the whole book, and it was basically a challenge to the whole Western civilization's worldview. And I think it was so much impressed all of us that we decided to call this whole organization worldview. So, we've broken it out, I think, into 14 different projects or activities that this institute does. And I think you're going to get a little booklet about them next week or something. But decided to call the whole thing worldview. Why? Because basically the main reason to study Buddhism is that there's a difference in the worldview, in the entire worldview, how you see the world, okay, between our civilization and what Buddhism teaches. The way the world works is described in contradictory manners. And a Buddhist walking into American civilization would say that we just got it wrong. And the way we're trying to relate to the world is incorrect, meaning, we relate to the world in a way which will never work. And it doesn't matter how hard you try or how sincere you are or how loving you are or how intelligent or sensitive or compassionate you are, if you relate to the world in a certain way, the way that Western civilization has taught you, you will suffer. Because it doesn't work. It's broken. And the whole concept of our civilization, our whole activity, what people do every day, what people do all day long, is just hopeless, and it doesn't work. And it's like trying to make a car go without pistons or something. And for millions, hundreds of millions of people to labor from morning to night trying to reach something that doesn't work, in a way that doesn't work, it's just like watching children with razor blades cut themselves, It's like, it's sad. And it won't work. And I think Master Shantideva, in his text, it's interesting, it's supposed to be a book about compassion, but I think what you get at the end is wisdom. And the 9th chapter, the chapter on wisdom, is something out of this world. And in a way, it brings you back to compassion in the best way a person could, which is to say, the view, the world view, the way that you view reality, the way you think things work is so wrong that you hurt yourself all day long. And And from the time you get up until the time you go to bed, all the people in this realm, and especially those who are following the beliefs of Western civilization, are actually hurting themselves every hour they're awake. It's better to go to sleep, okay, than to continue like that. It's better to go to bed, actually, because then you wouldn't hurt yourself so well, you know. And that was the challenge that Master Shantideva threw out. And that, to me, this is one of the greatest books ever written, and urge you to stick with it. We'll do the first third this class, and then when we get to the last of the three review courses, we'll get into the meat of the Bodhisattva Charavatara, okay? Of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. But I think, get the feeling that he's going to end up with one of the most extraordinary presentations of emptiness ever given. And he's using it because he's compassionate. And he's trying to teach us about what compassion is and what compassion means. Okay, so I'm going to start by putting out the structure of the Bodhisattva Charavatara, the way he does it. We've talked about the ninth chapter. There's about nine other chapters we have to talk about. Okay. First I'll give you the name of the book. I'll give you the short name. Say Chinjuk. Chinjuk. Chö means activities, and it refers to the things that bodhisattvas do, what bodhisattvas do. We were in Ireland, we were struggling for a word for bodhisattva. We didn't want to freak out all these guys. And we ended up with warrior saint, and they liked it, they got it, you know. So chö means the kind of activities they do, the kind of things that bodhisattvas do. Juk means, in Yiddish it means roach, and it's what they used to call me in the Diamond District. Hey, Juk. But in Tibetan, it means in Tibetan it means to enter, okay? Like entering the activities of a bodhisattva. It's been translated as Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. I like it. I think, you know, I usually hate all other translations, but this one's good, okay? Even though I didn't make it up. So Chinjuk, the author is, say Lopan, Shiva, Ha. Okay, good. Lopan means master. A professor from Harvard once complained about my lectures. He said, "You say master, you keep repeating the word master." You know, it's actually one of our vows. Okay, we're not supposed to refer to a great Buddhist wise man as Shantideva. It's considered improper. We're supposed to say Master Shantideva or the incomparable, brilliant, fantastic Master Shantideva, okay? You should get in the habit. Shiva means peace or Shanti. And Tha means God or angel, Deva. Okay. And his name is Shantideva, Master Shantideva. You remember his nickname, right? I like it. Say Dushi.
Dushi.
Sumbawa.
Sumbawa.
Those of you who are learning Tibetan, when a Dengbu bumps into a Sa Jenjuk, Sa secondary suffix, it changes almost to a Giku sound. So if you want your Tibetan to sound better, it's almost like Dushi. Okay, Dushi.
Dushi.
Sumbawa.
Dushi
Sumbawa. Dushi here means thinks about. Sumbawa means three things. The guy who only thinks about three things. Okay? And you know the story, but if you don't know the story, I'll tell you very briefly. Okay? Master Shantideva in Nalanda Monastery, ancient monastery in India, one of the great monasteries of all time, he would sit in his room and lay around on the bed. And people would come by to check on him, and he'd be sitting there laying down and not doing anything. And then he also seemed to be quite interested in meal times. And as a result of meal times, he used to go to the bathroom a lot. And he didn't seem to be interested in meditating or studying or memorizing or reciting or anything else. And they got fed up with him in the monastery. And, you know, he's an embarrassment to Nalanda Monastery. So they started to call him Mr. Three Thoughts, Dushi Sambhava. Only thinks about sleeping, eating, and pooping. Okay? in Sanskrit it's Bhusuku, okay? And he got this name Bhusuku. And they started to call him that. And then it got so bad and he was so useless that they decided to try to get him out of the monastery. So they said, they came to his room, you know, and they said, you know, all the monks are expected to give a teaching to the assembly every once in a while. We wondered if you'd like to come and give a teaching. And if you don't, you know, we kind of don't know if you should stay eating all our food and stuff. So they said, will you come and give a teaching? And he said, all right, you know, if you insist, I'll come, you know, and I'll teach something, you know. So they laughed and they said, oh, he's never going to be able to teach anything. And then on the special day that he came to teach, they got the chapel ready, you know, the assembly hall. And they purposely put a throne which was too high for a person to get up on it. Like, we built a throne in New Jersey for His Holiness, and for 10 years he couldn't get a visa to come, you know, to the United States. And it just sat there. And we never had any stairs to go up to it because, and it's about this high, you see? They made his much higher, Master Shantideva's. And you have to have a separate set of stairs that you wheel up to it. It's like an airplane stairs. And the Lama comes up and gets there. We didn't even have them because His Holiness couldn't get a visa. And we kept asking if he could come, and the government kept saying no. And then finally, I think it's 81, he got his first visa. But so for Master Shantideva, they just decided to leave it without the stairs and to embarrass him, because he wouldn't even be able to get up on the throne to teach. So on the given day, he came in to give a talk, and he made his three prostrations customary to the throne, meaning, you know, the Buddha is much better teacher than I am, and but I'll, you know, I'll sit there today. And then everyone was waiting, giggling, you know, waiting to see him try to get up on the throne, and suddenly he's on top already. You know, and everybody's like, how do you do that? And he's like looking down and he says, would you guys like me to teach something you've heard before or something new? You know, and they're like, yeah, right, something new. And so I said, all right, I wrote this little thing called Bodhisattva Charvatara, and I'd like to teach it to you today. So he starts teaching this thing, the Bodhisattva Charvatara, extraordinary, like one of the greatest books ever written. And the monks are just freaking out, you know. So there's this unbelievable, beautiful poetry. In Sanskrit, it's really beautiful poetry. And they're just, I can't believe what, and he's just talking extemporaneously. He's memorized the whole thing in Sanskrit. He's teaching it from memory, and they're freaking out. And then he gets to the ninth chapter. Ninth chapter is really hard. Like, people throughout history have written explanations of the ninth chapter. You guys got a really good ninth chapter, and we'll do another one in October, November, but he goes through all the fight between the mind-only school and the middle-way school and everybody else, and extraordinary teaching. So they're all like really anxious when he gets to this part about emptiness, and everyone's like paying attention and they're listening, and then suddenly he starts going off into this stuff that no one can grasp, you know, and then he's slowly rising off the throne, you know. And then people are, the great monks in the audience are like going into meditation so they can follow him, you know. And so their minds are like projecting out and following him into the air. And he's like flying up into the air, like every time he gets to another new subject, he's like getting higher and higher in the sky. And most of the monks are just lost already, you know, and they're like, where'd he go, where'd he go? And he's just flying, and then finally he just disappears like a spot in the sky, you know, he just disappears. And people are like, what did you hear? How many chapters did you hear? And he's like, it's 8. He said, no, I heard 9. You know, so I said, no, 10. You know, and there's a big argument about, they can't even figure out how many chapters there were, because half the people couldn't use like clairvoyance to keep up with him. You know what I mean? And then I don't know the story, they find him like 6 months later, just hanging out near this stupa down in South India like he's a nobody. And they send a big contingent of monks to beg him to come back, you know, and they apologize and for judging him, you know what I mean? And he says, well, you know, I don't really feel like coming back to your monastery. But I'll tell you what, I left the book in the rafters of my room. I wrote the Sanskrit out and the poetry is all there, and if you look in the rafters, you can find it, you know, and that's why we have it, okay, that's why we have the book. Then he wrote another book called Shiksha Samuchaya, which is rarely taught in the monastery, and His Holiness is teaching it in Bodh Gaya. He's halfway through, I understand, and so that's what we're going to hear for the millennium, so that's not a bad way to spend the It's the other great book by Master Shantideva. And I think it will be a classic also once it's translated well and taught. So anyway, that's the story of Master Shantideva. I think what you can learn from it is not to judge people in this class, your fellow students. You know, I tend to judge people constantly. You know, I was on a vacation the last week, and I was going to these country towns and seeing these rough, tough guys and thinking, oh, you know, they probably just think about bulldozers all day or something, you know. And then I was reflecting that the rancher who's selling us the property in Arizona turns out to be this extraordinary spiritual genius, you know. And then I begin thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't judge these guys with the bulldozers, you know. And I think you get the first thing to learn from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life is before you open the book, is to reflect that you don't know who's in this class and you don't know what other people are doing. In the monastery in Sarah, there are these older geshis who sit there quietly in the assembly and they don't say anything, and then there's a big debate and they'll get up, and you know, those other guys are looking really handsome and they're like, you know, like that, you know, and these guys get up and they go, you know, and they take some position which is indefensible, you know, like they take some silly position, and they, this really gunslinger, hot 40, 35-year-old geshe, you know, defending, you know, and they'll go up and they'll say, well, you know, it's blue a color, you know, and then the guy will say, of course it's a color, and then they got him already, you know, and then they just wander around, and then pretty soon you see this checkmate, you know, and this guy is like, you know, the guy's sitting down, and then they say, oh, I just wanted to check, you know, and they sit down real quietly, you know, and then everyone's like, you know, and people do that. I think you reach a certain spiritual level, you start to act like Joe Schmo, and seriously, I think people reach a certain spiritual level, and they just don't care who knows anymore. And they just look like Joe Schmo, like Dushe Sambhava, Mr. Sripas. And they don't care if you think that about them for 10 years, 20 years. They don't care. You know, maybe they got enlightened three lifetimes ago. You don't know. And I think the first lesson of this book is the circumstances under which it was first taught. And to keep that in mind. Who knows who the people around you are? And don't worry about it, you know. You have 84,000 mental afflictions up here to take care of, you know? And why double it or triple it by worrying about other people? When you have enough to work on the rest of your life. So I think that's the first great lesson for me in this book is that one. Okay. Now I'd like to go through the structure of the book, and I mean anybody in the class. Okay, I don't mean the people who look like they might be Master Shantideva. Okay, I'm talking about the people who definitely don't look like they're Master Shantideva. Those are the most dangerous ones. Okay. 10 chapters of the book. Okay. And I'm going to abbreviate the Say Penyun. Penyun. The first job of every Buddhist author in Mahayana is to try to sell you on the idea of bodhicitta. Is try to sell you that it's on the idea that it would be good for you to be a bodhisattva. So, you know, that's the way we always start in Buddhism. We try to get you excited about how great it would be to be a bodhisattva. So Penyun means the benefits of being a bodhisattva. That's the first thing that Master Shantideva does. Tries to describe the benefits of it. Okay. There's basically two kinds of bodhicitta, or what you call the wish for enlightenment. One is, well, there's three. Okay, Buram Gishing Tabu Semke means the bodhicitta which is like sugarcane. They call it sugarcane bodhicitta. And this is like a preliminary feeling that you get, like you get a little bit, you feel some kind of sympathy for other people, or you feel some kind of sweet feeling towards other people, and that's like the why it's called sugarcane is that it doesn't have strength. It's not strong like oak. It's like sugarcane. It's hollow on the inside, and it's like you start to get a taste of what it would be like to be a bodhisattva, and that's called sugarcane bodhicitta. It's not real bodhicitta. Okay, then you have some kind of a feeling of, how do you say, you have the lead up to bodhicitta, which is all the feelings of bodhicitta, like compassion for other people, love for other people. You start to have feelings of care for other people. Okay. And then you get a what we call like an elementary bodhicitta. The first basic bodhicitta goes under that second one, okay? And that's where it's actually a kind of renunciation, okay? It's a kind of disgust with this world. We described the desire realm already. We talked about the desire realm being a broken place. We talked about the fact that in this world, nothing you can do will help at all, okay? You always have in the back of your mind that if I made some adjustments to my life, it would be all right. If I ate better, if I got enough sleep, if I could eliminate two or three people from my world, you know, if I could, study a little more, if I had a little more time to meditate, then I'd be all right. Or if I could just change this relationship, it doesn't work. There is no adjustment. Forget the idea of adjustment. Right now your mind works on the idea, if I could make certain adjustments in my life, it would be okay. The point about the desire realm, which you are stuck in, is that whatever adjustment you make won't work. Okay? The minute you eat those vitamins, the minute you get more sleep, the minute you get a little more income, the minute you change your husband or wife, the new suffering will start again. And it'll be evident in about 6 weeks. You know what I mean? And that's all. You can't fix this realm. It doesn't work. And bodhicitta is realizing that that applies to everybody else also. That's all. You take your own knowledge of your own crappy situation and then you just turn it around on other people. There's this thing in the back of your mind that says, if I'm not happy, somebody else must be. You see, I mean, you walk down Fifth Avenue, I used to do it, and you imagine, okay, 10%, 5%, 1%, somebody's got to be happy. Somebody on this street's got to be happy. You know, somebody must have made all the adjustments necessary, and they're actually happy. I just have to find them, you know? And in the back of your mind, you have these two ideas. A, if I could adjust certain things in my life, it would be all right. B, there must be someone who's happy. You know, there's probably somebody who's having a happy marriage or somewhere. You know what I mean? And the fact is, no. Okay? No, it doesn't work. The realm doesn't work. You know, it's not like people aren't trying hard or something like that. The realm doesn't work. It doesn't matter what you do. It won't work out. Okay? And then, just to imagine that that's true of every other person around you is some kind of liberating thought. That's bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is renunciation applied by logic to other people. You can't be inside of their mind directly most of the time. But by logic, observing their own sufferings, you decide that they must be suffering as much as I am. Then later, especially with the direct perception of emptiness, you have the perception of bodhicitta of an arya, okay, of a person who has seen emptiness directly. And this is like some very powerful, direct, immediate, ultimate compassion and love, and you have it. And it's a whole few minutes of some extraordinary physical reaction in your body and knowledge and vision that you have. And then you are a bodhisattva. Okay, you have this, an arya bodhisattva. Okay, you have this direct experience of ultimate compassion. And that's where I want to start from. Okay, assuming you could get there, which is the subject of this book, you know, assuming you could reach that point where you have this happen to you during meditation, okay, and you will have, if you haven't had already, and who knows, okay, you will have or have had this direct experience of bodhicitta. Do you know it when you have it? Yes. Is it something like extraordinary and definable, and you won't question it. You won't say, maybe I had it, maybe I didn't. Let me go ask Michael, you know. It's not like that. You will know when you have it, and you have it. And it's this extraordinary experience, the first moment of perfect compassion and love for other beings, okay? And then what do you do the rest of your life? You see, the rest of your life, after that experience, you are a real bodhisattva. And then you, I don't know how to describe. You know, I meet different kinds of people. I worked in business for a long time, and we used to go around the world opening offices in different countries. And I would, like when we went to Bangkok, we didn't know one person in Bangkok, and we're supposed to open this big office, you know. We don't know a single person. Nobody knows Thai. We don't know a single person in Bangkok. I was supposed to open a $25 million office and staff it, you know. And so what do? We went to restaurants. We tried to see which waitresses could handle like 14 orders at once. And then we stole them. And and even to make the offer was funny because we couldn't speak Thai. So you had to get someone to talk to them and say, do you want to come work for an American company? Which most Thais don't like. And then that was another experience. But or you just find some guy who's a busboy or a porter in a hotel, but you'd see that he could handle 25 things at once. And then you take them, you train them for 6 months. We used to take people from the jungles of Northern Chiang Mai. Yeah, I remember one lady, you know, we offer a job. We said, we'll pay you like so many thousand baht per month or something, $40. And she says, No. And there's a big fight with the translator, you know, and I say, that's all we're giving her, you know. She doesn't know anything about diamonds or rubies, you know. And the guy explains, and there's another big fight. And then I said, what's the problem, you know? Everybody takes that salary. And she says, it's too much. And she refuses to take it. And these people, these are the kind of people you start with. Then you train them the business, and now they run the whole operation. $25, $30 million operation, being run by these farm girls from Chiang Mai, you know, but you just take them. The human mind is extraordinary. What I mean to say is that having worked in a big corporation, what dawned on me is that you could take almost any person from anywhere and train them, and the human mind is so extraordinary that if it's challenged and if you give them authority, you know, if you say, hey, look, this whole office is yours, here's $20 million, I'll be back next year, you know, try to make it 30, okay? And they just do it, you know, like anyone, because the human mind is like that. I mean, what I mean to say is that anybody in this room could probably do the same thing if they got the chance. You see what I mean? If just someone gave them a chance and trusted them and taught them a little bit and then threw them out into it and let them take their own chances and their own risks and not, you know, just inspire them and make them happy and let them go for it, then the human mind is such that you can do anything. I mean, we realize that busboys in restaurants in Thailand can run huge corporate offices. They just never get a chance. You see what I mean? The same state of mind that can handle four busboy trays can also handle, you know, $40 million of orders and juggle them and stuff like that. It's, every mind in this room has the same capacity. Just the human mind is not challenged. And so life is boring. And this is not listed by Shantideva, okay? I'm making this up. Life is boring. I mean, you're just not challenged, okay? Frankly, okay? I mean, if you do finally reach a place where you have enough money to have a place to stay, enough food, enough time, you'll just find that it's miserable anyway. You see, I mean, it's miserable to work, and it's miserable to be freed from work, okay? Because you find out that it's just miserable to be alive, you know? And it's miserable, you know what I mean? And you don't have any real big purpose. I mean, if we didn't have to struggle to make a living, and someone fed you and said, okay, you don't have to work, you'd go crazy, you know? You try it, you know? And people just, you just can't do it. And what I'm trying to say is that after you have that experience of bodhicitta, you see clearly the only way to spend a human life, and the only way to challenge, really challenge the human mind. You see, I mean, when you first become a bodhisattva, and you see, you have this vision of your future, you can see the whole thing laid out into the future, and you see what you're going to be doing for the next, 500 years or so, You know, and you see it clearly, and you can think, and you say, man, and you know what you're going to be doing for the next 5 minutes, and it is unbelievable. You know what I mean? You're like, I will spend every waking moment of my time serving other people and doing heavy duty Dharma all the time. And I know what I have to do, and I know what I'll be doing, I know how to do it, I know most of the details of what I have to do. And you have this mission, you know what I mean? And you have this future laid out for you, and every single moment of it is the most sweet, holy, sacred use of a human life that you can imagine, you know? And then your whole life is taken care of. It's just extraordinary. You know, that whole feeling of knowing that you have something important to do and that you can do it every moment from here on out for the rest of your life, that what you will do will be the most holy, beneficial thing you can do with human life. And it's a whole different feeling after that. You know what I mean? I'm trying to convey what it would be like to have that feeling of knowing what your life is going to be and knowing that you, of all people, will be spending it in the most holy, sweet, beneficial way that a human being can spend their time. And this whole, you know, most people are working hard because they don't want to face the fact that there's nothing meaningful to do. You know what I mean? Like, period. Okay? Even the people here in this room who are successful and who have found a niche for themselves, great artist, great filmmaker, great businessman, great author, whatever, you're really just trying to keep yourself busy because life is so meaningless. And there's so many years left to burn up, you know? And I'm trying to say is, once you get to that realization of bodhicitta, then you, for the first time, you see how to spend human life. And it is totally brilliant and beautiful, and every single moment, waking, sleeping, they say, standing over the toilet or sitting on it, whichever you are, even that much time is spent, you know, thinking about other people and thinking about the wonderful things you can do to help other people, and in an ultimate way. You know, we're not talking feeding people or finding them a place to sleep. We're talking about teaching other people not to die, or teaching other people to get out of this broken realm and reach a tantric paradise. You know, and your whole, even when you stand over the toilet or sit on it, okay, your whole life you see clearly ahead of you what you will do, and that every single moment will be engrossed in that activity. And you can't imagine what it feels like, you know, to spend a whole life like that with meaning, something meaningful. Because everything else is not meaningful, okay? And that's my advertisement for bodhicitta. Okay, that's penyin. That's penyin. That's, imagine what it feels like to be totally engrossed in every moment, waking or sleeping, in a totally meaningful thing that will help every living being. All the time. Imagine what it would feel like to be like that, okay? And that's what a bodhisattva feels like. This book is an instruction manual for people who want to live their life like that, okay? At the beginning, you do it artificially, okay? It's called kunzong. You know, at the beginning, it's called chirpa. You fake it. You try to act like a bodhisattva. Okay, and trying to act like a bodhisattva makes you able to do it later. Okay, but at the beginning, it's just reading this little instruction manual, how to be a bodhisattva. Master Shantideva is very kind, and Gyaltsev Jay too. He starts calling you bodhisattva from the beginning of the book. Oh, you bodhisattva, want to know how to do it? You know, and it really you're not. You see what I mean? And they're being very kind. From the beginning of the book, they keep calling you bodhisattva, you know. Okay, bodhisattva, here's what you do first. Think about the opinions of this way of life, spending the rest of your life in something which is ultimately meaningful for other people, which saves them from every form of pain and gets them straight into a tantric eternal paradise. You know, hey, how about that for a career? Okay? And that's the advertisement. That's how the book starts. And you've got to get that feeling. If you study this book, that's what you're trying to reach. And you can't imagine how it feels to spend every moment of your life like that, knowing that everything you do is saving people's lives in an infinite way. Okay? It's just a whole different level of how to spend your life. And anything less than that is boring. and it's not satisfying, and you can smell it and you feel it, especially if you happen to get more than 2 weeks vacation to think about it. You know, like the only thing that saves most of us from going insane is that we've managed to keep ourselves busy enough at a job so we don't have to think about it. You know what I mean? But it's meaningless. Everything else is meaningless. To serve others, to spend your whole life serving others in an ultimate way, it's the sexiest thing to do. And it's fun. And it's 24 hours a day, you know, and it gets better and better every day. Okay? I mean, it starts out fantastic. Gyalpo Jay, Master Shani Deva says, blissed out going to bliss. That's how he calls it. And the path is bliss, and the result is bliss. And it gets better every single day. And that's Bodhisattva's way of life. It's just amazing. It's just like finally something to do. Okay? Number two. Say Shakpa. Shakpa. Shakpa means to cut wood, to split wood, and by extension it has come to mean to open your heart and to admit your failings, like to purify yourself of bad deeds, bad karma. Dikpa Shakpa means to admit your bad karma openly, like splitting open wood. Okay? The reason this chapter is here, this is chapter 2, is that we all have mental blinders. You know, horses have those things, I don't know what you call them, blinders? Yeah, and they keep them from seeing what's off to the side because they would freak out, you know. And we all have these inherent obstacles in your mind, meaning there's a diseased part of your mind that says, oh, 50 weeks a year of collecting money to spend it for 2 weeks a year makes sense. Okay? That makes sense. You know, 98% of the time I give to them and I get, 96% of the time I give to them and I get 4% back. Good deal. You know, and then you have these blinders that refuse to admit that this life is a waste. You know, refuse violently. Somebody gets up and says that, you say, no. You know, my life has meaning. You know, I have meaning. My life has meaning. I'm not just going to work and collecting money and going to die someday and lose everything I'm working for. No, there's meaning, you know. And your mind doesn't want to face it. Your mind avoids it. You know, every time you get close to it, your mind, there's something about your mind that says, take care of yourself. Don't think about other people. You know, you can't give away everything. You'll be in trouble, you know. It's not a good idea. It's naive. It's fanatical. The guy is getting you to act like a cult, you know. And no, these things are meaningful. And your mind is comfortable with that. You know, it's meaningless, but it's comfortable. And to try to think differently is painful. And what Shakpa does, Shakpa is the process of admitting your own bad karma. It's like, okay, you had an abortion, or you hurt somebody bad, or you did something to hurt someone deeply, or something like that, and to admit it, and to clean them from your mind stream, and then suddenly you wake up one day, because of the cleansing process, you wake up and say, you know what, it makes more sense to take care of other people. You see, just to come to that position in your mind is extremely difficult. You have all these mental obstacles to reaching that place where you say to yourself, you wake up one morning and you say, you know, it's a lot more fun and a lot more meaningful, and in fact the only meaningful thing to do with my life is to help other people. You know, it makes a lot more sense to help others than to spend a whole grubbing life trying to take care of myself when I'm just going to be rotting in a couple of years anyway. You know what I mean? Just to wake up one morning and have this realization is a result of doing chapter 2. Get it? Okay? Like, if you could purify your own mind by admitting the mistakes you'd made in the past and getting rid of that bad karma, at some point the hurdle would be low enough that you could make it over it and realize that you should spend your life for other people. Okay? And not for number one. Because number one is the lost case anyway. Okay? And that the best thing you can do for number one is to take care of other people. Okay? That's just, to get to that point is very difficult and it takes a lot of mental purification. It takes a lot of spiritual purification. That's why Master Shantideva puts this as chapter number 2. Okay? You will never get to compassion unless you get rid of a lot of your old bad karma. Okay? Unless you clean a lot of your old bad karma off your mind stream, you will never understand compassion. Compassion will always seem stupid or naive or fanatical or simple-minded or cultish or something, you know? That whole idea of taking care of other people and not worrying so much about yourself is naive, you know? Try to tell it to half the people in New York. They think, come on, that guy's taking advantage of you. Are you crazy? You know? He's just trying to get you to donate to his Arizona project or something, you know? Okay, and it's to be accused of being naive or something like that. And to believe it, when you believe it, it's because you have this bad karma. You have old bad karma in your mind. To believe that you have to take care of yourself and not worry about other people is an obstacle. And you have to go through chapter 2 to get to the rest of the book, or you won't be interested in the rest of the book. Okay? Number 3. Say, Jangsem. Sungwa. Jangsem. Sungwa. Jangsem is short for bodhicitta. Okay? The wish for enlightenment. Sungwa means obtaining it or getting it. Okay? If chapter 2 was getting rid of the negative karma in your mind that keeps you from realizing that taking care of others is the smartest thing you can do and the most exciting thing you can do with your life, then what do you guess number chapter 3 is about? It's the opposite. Okay, what's that? It's getting together the good karma that would help you to get bodhicitta also. You see what I mean? So chapter 2 is like how to clean out all the crap. Chapter 3 is how to collect the good energy that you need to get up to bodhicitta. You see what I mean? So it's not just enough to remove all the bad karma, old bad karma in your mind that makes you think selfishly. You have to collect a lot of good karma too. Okay? And actually chapter 3 is devoted, although it's called obtaining bodhicitta, its main function is all those sweet things of how to collect good karma. Here we're talking about like Ganen Hagyama, you know, the Jetsun Kapa practice that we learned, or the seven limb puja thing, the seven limb practice. What you got in the seven limbs is a bunch of limbs devoted to cleaning out your negative karma, especially shakpa, okay? And then you have a lot of limbs to charging up your battery, you know, collecting enough good karma to take you over your spiritual obstacles, okay? So you have a two-way process. You're cleaning away the old bad karma and you're charging up your spiritual batteries with new good karma. And you need to do both. So chapter 3 is dedicated to certain spiritual practices which you do every morning when you warm up for your meditation. They're there, okay? Straight from Master Shantideva. Most of them come straight from here. Okay, the whole process of making offerings, prostration, rejoicing, requesting teachings, things like that, those are all found in this chapter. Collecting heavy-duty good karma, okay? Charging your batteries. To try to get up to the point where you realize that the only meaningful thing to do with your life is to help other people, okay? And it feels so good, okay? I mean, you know, when you come out of the hospital, you visited somebody you didn't really want to visit, and you feel like a hero, you think that the guard is going to put a medal on your, you know, you come out with your head up and your back straight, and you just feel so good for like 10 minutes, you know? Like you know when you've done something really good. And then imagine how that feels all day long, every minute of the day, to know you're doing the best thing for everybody, all the time, is that feeling, okay? Number 4. Say Bhagya.
Bhagya.
Bhagma in ancient Tibetan language means a bride, you know, who was supposed to be this, you know, and you'd come and get married to some guy and you had to move into their house and you become the slave of the family, and whatever the mother-in-law wants, you have to wash all the dishes forever. And Bhagma means like to stay shy and modest and, you know, don't say anything ever. And Bhakya came from that word. Bhakya means careful in everything you do. Like very careful. Okay. Mindful, careful. Call it carefulness. Okay. This refers to not blowing it after you get pretty good compassion. Okay, it means like how to watch yourself. That okay, now he taught about compassion. I get it, and he's taught the bodhisattva activities. I understand that what a bodhisattva has to do, and now I have to try to protect that state of mind. I cleaned out my old bad karma. I collected a lot of new good karma. Now I finally reached a place where I halfway sense that it would be important to live for other people. Now take care of that state of mind like a new, like a little baby bonsai plant or something. You know what I mean? Like a fresh sprout. You have to protect it and take care of it and feed it and nurture it. That's bhagya. That chapter is devoted to methods of protecting your baby bodhicitta. Okay? Carefulness. It's all a process, right? He doesn't just call it six chapters, six perfections. He doesn't do that. He's got it all designed a different way. What's he leading up to? Chapter 9. That's where he took off, right? All right, here we go. Chapter 5. Say Shishin.
Shishin.
Shishin means mindfulness. Okay. Technically, in the study of meditation, it's the state of mind that watches your mind and rings the bell when you get chingwa or gopa. What's that? Yeah, dullness and agitation. Dullness is like spacing out. Gopa is like thinking about what's for lunch. Okay. And Shishin watches your mind. And when he sees you spacing out or thinking about what's for lunch, blows a whistle. You know, we got a problem here. Okay, and then it brings you back. You see what I mean? And then you think, oh yeah, I'm meditating. Okay, okay. And Shishin is the one that catches yourself. Okay. Now, Master Shantideva names the chapter on the second perfection, Shishin. What's the second perfection of the six? Yeah, Sutram. Okay, ethical way of life. Okay, the perfection of an ethical way of life. Okay, I don't like the word morality much. I always think of Billy Graham and can't smoke and can't read certain magazines and stuff like that. You know, I think to me, ethical way of life means every moment of my day I have to be honest. I can't lie. You know what I mean? Like that. And that's perfection number two is going to be covered in chapter 5 under the code word watching yourself. Okay, being mindful, all right? Because that's the main component of being ethical, is to catch yourself when you start to lie, okay? Or catch yourself when you start to sneak something, or something like that, doing something sneaky, okay? That's Shishin. What happened to perfection number one? What is perfection number one? Giving. A little bit comes in Chansan Sumo, where you're collecting new good karma, right? Like offering and stuff like that. But hey, that's not the only kind of giving. Maybe it comes later. We'll see. Okay. Six. Say sopa.
Sopa.
Sopa. People call it patience. When I think of patience, I think of waiting for a bus or a dentist. To me, it's like the art of not getting angry. You know, that's too long, but anyway, it's the art of not getting angry. When the time is right, usually you have about 3 seconds to pull out your sopa, and then it's too late. Okay, personally, that's what happens to me. I usually remember 15 minutes later, 24 hours later, okay? But you have about, between the time the person says something and the time you start to respond, you have what, 3-4 seconds. That's the window of opportunity for this perfection, sopa. That's it. You have to respond, and you have to catch yourself within 3-4 seconds. That's all the time you have. It's not very pleasant, and it's very destructive. Anger destroys good karma like nothing else in the universe. Okay? A few minutes of anger can destroy years of a relationship. And the karma also. Years of good karma can be destroyed in a few minutes of true anger. Okay? Sopa. And that's perfection number 3. Okay? chapter 7. Say tsundu.
Tsundu.
Tsundu has been translated as effort. I like to translate it as joyful effort. What it boils down to is having a good time doing Dharma. Okay? It's to get off on doing Dharma. And I love to translate it that way, and I love it if you think of it that way. You know, effort sounds like sweat and grunting to me. Okay? Tsundu is like giggling and laughing and sharing food and you know, going out and doing another Dharma project together and getting excited about, oh, here's another way to do something cool to help people, you know. And just, you know, bonding with your other people in your group who want to do stuff like that and working together and you know, to me it's like sitting around on Michael Wick's stained carpet and talking about our next neat thing we can do to help people, you know. And that's what it is, okay? Tsundu is like that. Tsundu is like, hey man, you know what else we could do, you know? We could just, let's print diamond cutter sutras and give them away again in Mongolia. Yeah, 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 good idea. Now, let's get somebody to pay for the cloth too. Yeah, 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 okay, you know. And, you know, and then you go out and do it. And to feel the feeling of giving them away, thousands of people rushing up to the stage to get their free diamond cutter sutra, you know. And that whole energy, you know, that's tsundu, okay? That pure, happy energy. Happy energy, okay? It's like that. It's not like, oh, I gotta meditate again, you know? And I gotta do that dakke thing again, oh my God. I don't have enough money for the bus. Oh, they're doing it in New York. I don't have enough money for the subway. No. Okay, anyway. What is the next one? Something probably, right? Yeah. Say something.
Something.
Meditation. Okay. Meditation. Perfection of meditation. You've got to have it to see emptiness directly. Period. We talked about it before. Hour to 2 hours a day in deep meditation on a single object. Okay. Must have or cannot see emptiness directly. Will not escape the desire realm in this life. Your choice is yours. Okay? Stay in a broken realm that cannot work. Why can't you meditate today? I have something else to do. Why? It doesn't matter what. You're dealing with a broken thing. It's not going to work. Whatever else you have to do is not going to work. And that's an excuse not to meditate? You know what I mean? It's funny. It's a sad thing, actually. Okay? Whatever else you're going to do doesn't work. It won't bring you what you want. It just doesn't work. What do you think causes money? What do you think causes security? Taking care of other people. That's the only thing. If you happen to get any money or security, it only came because you did something for other people in the past. It has nothing to do with your current intelligence, your current dealings, your current effort at work. Nothing. They're not cause and effect. Okay? No connection between your income and how much you sweat at work. No connection at all. Get used to it. Okay? The only source of money is to take care of other people. Okay? And the more you do, the more you'll get. Period. That's Buddhist worldview. It clashes with Western worldview. Now you gotta choose. Okay? Get your name in the New York Times? What page? Front page or the obituary? You know, founder of such and such a company. That's all it is. You go straight from the front page to the back page. And that's the story. No, that's the story. That's the best you can do. You know, be in there twice. And no, it doesn't work. It's wrong. It doesn't work. Okay? Okay. 9. Shittim. Sweetest chapter of all. This is where Master Shantideva dukes it out with Indian worldview. You know, what was it? 700 AD, something like that. Okay? He's duking it out. By the way, the Indian worldview is the same as the Western worldview. It hasn't changed any. Ignorance hasn't changed. Okay? He's duking it out with those guys that say, the world was made from a big explosion. Or the guys that are saying, the world was made by this big powerful guy. Oh, who was he made by? Some other big powerful guy? I don't know. Okay? Stuff like that. Alright? He dukes it out. He set up all these worldviews, and there's this big boxing match. It's like watching Muhammad Ali and a bunch of other guys fight it out, or Bruce Lee, you know. And really, it's just like that. It's a war for your mind, okay? It's a war for your worldview. And he sets up those other worldviews, and they're not wimpy. They're not stupid people. These are sophisticated people. These are sophisticated arguments. And then he stands there and he destroys them, one by one. On fair terms, okay? He actually addresses each one of their questions and demolishes it. And at the end, he's the only guy left standing. Okay? It's a brilliant, it's a beautiful chapter. Okay? It's like, by the time you get to the end of that chapter, you don't have anything else to believe in except that worldview. Okay? It's a beautiful chapter. Okay, number 10, then we'll take a break. Say Loa.
Loa.
Loa means dedication. Okay? Normally at the end of class we say Kewa Di, Kewa Kun. By that time your mind is already on the summary, right? Try to think to the second line, okay? Which is by this virtue that I collected during this class, hearing these holy things that nobody else ever talks about. You know, may everyone get a holy tantric angel's body and mind, you know? Basically that's the prayer. Who wrote it? Nagarjuna, okay? Master Nagarjuna, alright? Direct from one of his words. We say it every class. That's dedication. Dedication is taking the good karma that you just did and putting it in the karmic bank before you have a chance to blow it by getting irritated on the way out at one of your fellow students. Okay? Because that irritation destroys the good karma. So actually, you consciously at the end of class say, I did something good today, I give it away to other people. You know? And then all that energy goes out to other people. It's like invested, reinvestment. The whole idea of a good Buddhist is reinvesting your good karma. Okay? Reinvestment of good karma. Okay? By the way, there's only 10 chapters, right? As far as we know. Where did giving go? This is giving. Okay? Giving was saved for last. And it's an extraordinary chapter. In Tibetan monasteries, we recite the 10th chapter by itself as a prayer. Just because it's so beautiful, you know, he's like praying that he could turn his body into rain and fall into hot hells and help people and stuff like that. Every woman who's giving birth at this moment, may I take away their pain with this karma that I just collected. Stuff like that. Beautiful, beautiful. Over and over, like hundreds of lines, over and over again. He's thinking of every person in the world who's having a problem right at this moment, may my body turn into what they need and I give it to them. You know, and he's like extraordinary. Chapter, last chapter. Okay, that's giving. Okay, that's the structure of the Bodhisattva's way of life. And think about it. Okay, think about. I mean, deep down inside, I think most intelligent people have a pretty clear awareness that their life is meaningless. You know, and they hide it. I think the most talented people hide it by keeping themselves too busy to think about it. And I'm speaking from personal experience, okay? Like you hide it. You hide from it by keeping busy. Because to be faced starkly with how meaningless your day is just too much to think about. And so you make sure you have enough appointments so you don't have time to think about it, you know? And what I'm trying to do is imagine a kind of life where you are literally saving thousands or tens of thousands of people from this broken realm and taking them to some like holy paradise or something, that you could do that. And that would be the most beautiful way to spend your life, and the most meaningful way to spend your life. And you don't have to quit your current meaningless job to do that, because then it would become a meaningful job. You see, bodhisattvas hang out wherever they are. It doesn't matter. You can work in a company. You can have a family. You can be a normal person, but you got to be a bodhisattva. You got to be thinking like a bodhisattva. And you got to be doing these 10 things while you're at your place, whether it's your office, or it doesn't matter. Bodhisattvas don't just go around in red suits teaching Dharma all day. You know what I mean? They work in normal companies. They do normal business. They have normal relationships with other people. They have meaningful family life. They do everything a normal person does, but with a totally different frame of mind. And that's a bodhisattva's way of life. I'm not saying you have to change your external life. You probably shouldn't. You have to change your internal life so that it becomes this mission constantly. You're at work and you are a high, holy, sacred being, warrior, you know, carrying out the sacred acts of a bodhisattva in your office in Manhattan. And if you think you have to go somewhere else to do it, you don't get it, because there isn't any place else to do it, okay? You have to do it where you are. And you can be this holy warrior wherever you are, wherever you work, wherever you live, with whomever you are. And that's the whole point of this book. People might not know it. They might call you Dushi Sumbhava, right? Mr. or Mrs. Three Thoughts. Doesn't matter, okay? But again, you can do it anywhere. And you have to think about it, okay? We'll take a break there. And talk to you later. Okay. Okay, we'll start. Just very briefly, this series of talks at the end has been about how the Dharma might spread in the West. And I wanted to talk very briefly about priorities, okay? The question of priorities. And I think what's happened in the West up to now is that there's been this Dharma Center thing happen. It means a Tibetan Lama comes to the United States, or someone goes to India and meets a Tibetan Lama, and they say, how would you like to start a Dharma Center? Or they ask the Lama, can I start a Dharma Center? And they come back home, and they sometimes they rent a place, sometimes they use their own home, and then the Lama says, I'll live there, and sometimes they live there, sometimes they don't, sometimes they visit once a year, you know. But anyway, a Dharma Center starts, and then there's two or three dedicated people who normally get it started, and then they get involved with keeping it going, and then comes the question of funding it and finding people to help out and things like that, and then the teacher comes. And in the early years in the United States, there was this kind of a weird thing going on where lamas were almost like kept captive in these Dharma centers, and it was considered like improper to ask for money. You know what I mean? I mean, the lama was supposed to be like starving all the time, but the students could have a regular job and make money, and then they would give little gifts to the lama, you know, and the lama, it would be considered impolite if the lama said, you know, why can't I have a normal salary or something like that. I mean, it was considered weird. For Ken Rinpoche, we gave him a salary of $115 a month, and that was a big deal, you know. And then he was supposed to survive on that and be happy with that because he's a lama. You know what I mean? And it was weird. And then you would go to school and pay $30,000 for tuition so they could get you to read Peter Pan, which one of my students is doing at the most expensive college in the United States currently. Okay? And then there's this weird thing, you know, like, it's no problem to pay $30,000 to read Peter Pan, but this lama who's teaching you not to die, it was weird to give him more than, you know, enough to live on, or just barely live on, and that's still the case at almost every Dharma center. It's a kind of slavery or something, I don't know. And the Tibetans said okay, because they didn't have any money, you know, and well, of course they wanted to spread the Dharma and help people, but the whole thing was a little bit, I don't know, That whole thing was weird. I'm not talking about that tonight. I'm talking about something else. By the way, the Ganden Tipa, the head of the throne of the Tsongkhapa, was kept captive in the back of a of a factory floor in Manhattan, and I used to go and visit him, you know. He had a curtain around a bed in the back of this huge factory floor, nothing else, you know, and he'd say, "Help," you know, and I'd say, "Don't worry," you know. Anyway, that's not what I'm talking about tonight. I think they should get a decent regular salary. I think we should raise funds, pay them $50,000-$60,000 a year like any other full professor, and period. You know what I mean? The whole thing, the idea that we should decide that they should live in poverty, is weird. You know, that's a whole other story. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about another thing, a whole different thing, which is that this phenomenon happens in the Dharma Center, that the people who could do the most good, you know, that if they studied and meditated and practiced, end up trying to run the place. And I call it the FTMT Administrator Syndrome. FTMT is a great organization, thousands of students, serving thousands and thousands of people around the world. But as I travel from center to center, the most talented, the most spiritually talented people are often the directors of the centers, and then their practice goes down the drain. You know, their own practice collapses. You know what I mean? Like you say, "How's your meditation?" They say, "Meditation, I haven't had time to sleep for 3 days, you know." And you say, "Well, what are you doing?" You know, "So I'm running in the center. What do you think I'm doing? You know, I gotta work. See you later. I gotta run. You know, there's a plumbing problem," or, you know, and they spend their time like that. I'd like to suggest that in the West, as we start to build more centers, or you can call them churches or temples, it doesn't matter, but as we start to build more places, that the very people who administer things, and that includes this organization, right, such as it is, that those people who administer things shouldn't ever use that as a reason not to do their practice. See, I mean, there should be a prioritization of your life. Projects are good. We have 14 major projects. We're helping 2,000 Tibetan refugees. We are saving all the Tibetan books in the world, blah, blah, blah. But if you don't do your own practice, what does it mean? You see, I mean, if you're the person who's in charge of these projects, whose goal is the spiritual well-being of all people, and your spiritual well-being is no good because you're too busy administering the spiritual well-being project, then what does it mean? You see what I mean? And I just wanted, that's just my thought about that the people in charge of this organization or the people in charge of other Dharma centers, the people who come to be doing the administration of these places, which are normally the most talented people. You know, you have Art Engel out in New Jersey packing books on the weekend when he could be translating any scripture in the world, you know, because these are the people who care. But that their own practice should never take second seat. And then as you get to be an administrator and as time goes on, you tend to hide behind that. You know, you say, "Yeah, I didn't do the homeworks last class. I was administering the last class." But that's no good. I say you have to do both, okay? Like, if you're up to that point where you're helping to administer a Dharma group, you should be doing both. What? You should be administering it very well, putting your heart into it, giving it your time, and then on top of that, you must do your practice. And if there comes a nungdom, what's a nungdom? A spiritual prioritization conflict, which in the Vinaya is a very important thing, you know? I'm supposed to go do sojong tonight, but my Ne Lama just died. My personal spiritual tutor has just died, but I am required by the monk's vows to go to this ceremony tonight. Now that's called a nungdom in the Vinaya, meaning two virtues are required of you by the laws of the Vinaya at the same time. So what are you going to do? Okay, you have to drop one and pick the other. That's prioritization. You have to know which one is more important. And I just want to say in 2 minutes that in this organization, whenever it comes down to that, that, you know, it's a question between your personal practice and some other administrative activity, drop the administrative activity, you know. And if that thing doesn't happen, or if that thing doesn't get bought, or that building doesn't get built, or that stupa doesn't get, that's okay, because the whole purpose of those is for your own spiritual practice. Well, isn't that selfish, you know what I mean? Isn't that wrong to choose your personal practice over all these important Dharma projects? No. Why? Bodhicitta. Okay, but what is bodhicitta? Bodhicitta is the decision to reach a tantric paradise yourself quickly as you can so you can really help other people. Because right now you're just doing desire realm help. You know what I mean? You're a desire realm being doing desire realm help in a broken world, doing broken things that are all going to go away anyway. On the other hand, if you perfected your practice, then you would be in a tantric paradise and you could teach people how to get there. And then they don't need another land purchase or building, you know what I mean? In the desire realm. Get it? So what I'm saying is that there's this bad tendency that the most talented people get drawn towards the busy work. And you have to be very strict. If you're one of those people, you have to be very strict as time goes by that you hold the line on your practice. You know, because that's what really helps other beings. Is for you to get your rear end into a tantric paradise before you die. Okay? And the projects will give you the good karma to help, but they can't replace the personal practice that's necessary. Hours in the morning or whenever meditating, keeping your own book strictly every couple of hours, doing your tantric retreats, I say twice a year, 1.5 months each, something like that. They don't replace those things. You have to do those things. And then the other stuff will come automatically. You see, I mean, the good karma from doing your practice means the other stuff will automatically get done. But the big mistake I see happening in America is the most talented people get wrapped up in administration, think it's a virtue to break their own practice or not do their own practice or exhaust themselves so that they can't do their practice. And then that's not how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be that your practice is so fantastic that, you know, the sponsor comes up to you and says, here, have $1 million. You know what I mean? And you don't have to go out and struggle like that. It, what really causes the world to become a pure realm is your personal practice. So to give that up for desire realm good result doesn't make any sense. You see what I mean? So I think in this organization, as it grows, teachers especially have to hold the line. There may be, in the early years, not enough doctors to go around for all the sick people. But that doesn't mean that you drop your practice and just help people all day, because you're not helping people all day. You have to have your time that you do your meditation, that you see emptiness directly, that you do your tantric practices, that you do your retreats, and that's how you really help people. And you have to keep that in mind. Otherwise, just to get exhausted and then to burn out and drop your personal practice, that's a mistake. That's not understanding the Dharma. Okay? Perfection of giving is perfected when? Had the Buddhas of the past perfected the perfection of giving? Yes or no? Yeah. Okay. Are there any poor people left in the world? This is Master Shanti Devi. You're going to get it next class, I think. Okay. Yes, there are. Yeah. So they didn't perfect giving, right? Teaching. Yeah. No, of course they did. Okay? It's a state of mind. Oh, so if it's just a state of mind, I don't have to give real things to real people. Teaching, okay? Yeah, you have to go through that debate, okay? In your mind, okay? And that's the debate, okay? Did they perfect the giving? Yes. Are there any poor people left in the room? Yes. So they didn't perfect giving, right? No, that's not what I said. Oh, so perfect giving is just a thing in your mind. Right. So I don't have to give real things to real people. No. Okay? That's a debate. You have to go through that. All right? You can't take care of all the... They're endless. The needs are endless. Especially in the early years when there are not enough people to go around to teach all the other people. So you'll just burn out. You have to keep your personal practice, because that's how you perfect yourself and become a Buddha and help other people. And that's the real meaning of ultimate compassion. That's what real compassion wants to do. And you've got to get used to that. So it means I should ignore other people. No. Okay? You've got to get used to that. Right? No, it doesn't mean that. Okay? Within the capacity that you have to perfectly serve other people. And then you have perfected the Bodhisattva's way of life to the ultimate that you can without breaking your practice. Okay? And that's all. Okay? Don't get that administrator syndrome. I don't like to see it. And I've seen very fine people lose themselves that way and then not serve anybody after a few years. Okay? Alright. The best thing you can do is perfect your own understanding and then perfect your own practice. Okay? We'll do a prayer. I think we got Kunzo? No. Yeah, don't hire. No, no, you. Sanshi Bhakti Joshi Dhamdham Nila Bhinshi Nile Yambali Sangye Shinda Nidre Uvahi Adokun